If you want to build a house on Earth, the absolute hardest part is paying for the materials.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
But if you want to build a city in space, I mean, the materials are actually completely free.
Just floating right out there.
Exactly. There are literally thousands of Earth's worth of steel, rock, and water just, floating around for the taking.
Yeah, the materials aren't the issue at all.
Right. The absolute hardest part is figuring out how to build a roof that stops the universe from, well, instantly killing you.
Is the tricky part, yeah.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are exploring this massive collection of source material on space settlement. And our mission here is to figure out how humanity might realistically build permanent, self-sustaining homes in the absolute void of space.
Which is just a wild concept to wrap your head around.
It really is. And we are moving completely past science fiction today. We're digging into the actual rigorous physics and engineering of how this gets done.
And right off the bat, I think we need to draw a very strict line in the sand about what we mean by a space settlement. Okay, lay it on us.
Because the International Astronautical Federation makes a really crucial distinction here. When you look at something like the International Space Station, right?
Yeah, the ISS.
Right. That is a space habitat. It's essentially an office building. It's a laboratory where humans go to work, but, they eventually come home.
But they don't live there forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A space settlement is entirely different. It is a permanently inhabited community. We are talking about integrated infrastructure.
Like actual neighborhoods and stuff?
Yeah. Power plants, agriculture, waste management, neighborhoods. It's not a place you just visit. It is a place you move to forever.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because taking a concept that sounds like, I don't know, a movie plot,
Yeah.
and realizing that scientists have been treating it as a mathematical certainty is just wild.
It's been taken seriously for a long time.
Yeah, the idea itself goes way back. I mean, Edward Everett Hale wrote a story in 1869 called The Brick Moon.
Classic.
And the Russian pioneer Konstantin Tsiolkovsky was drawing up rotating cylinders back in 1903, right, way before we even had airplanes, really.
But the moment this stopped being fiction and started being like actual math, that happened in the 1970s at Princeton University.
That transition is honestly one of my favorite pieces of science history.
It's so good.
You had Gerard O'Neill, who was an experimental physicist at Princeton, and he was teaching this freshman engineering class.
Just a standard undergrad class.
Yeah, just freshmen. And he wanted to give them a homework assignment that would really fire up their imaginations.
Oh.
So he asked them to calculate the actual, physical feasibility of building a massive space settlement.
Wait. So this entire field of study basically started as freshman physics homework.
It literally did. And the shock was that when the math came back, the numbers actually worked.
Wow.
Yeah, they proved that you could build massive rotating cylinders like
Yeah.
miles across using completely ordinary mid-20th century materials.
We're talking steel, glass, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Steel, glass, aluminum. They didn't need magical sci-fi force fields or anything like that. They solved the math for sunlight angles, orbital stability, even farming.
That is incredible from a homework assignment.
I know. And that one assignment launched a whole movement. It led to this massive 1974 article in Physics Today, O'Neill's book, The High Frontier, and these really highly influential NASA summer studies in 1975.
I'm getting a bit hung up on the basic logic here, though.
Okay, what's sticking?
Well, why go to all this trouble? I mean, we have perfectly good air, water, and gravity right here on Earth.
Yeah.
Are we just designing these massive trillion-dollar lifeboats because we've given up and assume Earth is doomed?
Not at all. And, that's actually a really common misconception. The motivation isn't about escaping a dying planet.
Oh, it's not.
No, it's about a shift away from what the researchers in the sources call planetary chauvinism.
Planetary chauvinism, that's a great term.
It really is. It's the assumption that human beings absolutely require a planetary surface to live on.
Like we have to be stuck to a big rock.
Right. But the real driving force here is unimaginable economic growth. I mean, what's fascinating here is if you look at just the main asteroid belt in our solar system,
Okay.
the raw, free-floating material out there is enough to build habitats equaling the habitable surface area of 3,000 Earths.
3,000 Earths. That is hard to even wrap your head around.
It's staggering. Think about the economy of scale there. A 1974 estimate suggested that using those resources, the human population could comfortably extend into the trillions.
Trillions of people.
Trillions. And all without strip mining or destroying Earth's natural ecosystems.
So it's not a lifeboat, it's essentially a gold rush.
Exactly, a cosmic gold rush.
But that brings us to the logistics, right? Yeah. Let's say we actually want to build one of these things. We know there's endless material in the asteroid belt.
Yeah.
But launching heavy steel beams from Earth on top of chemical rockets just to get the project started is impossibly expensive.
Oh, it would bankrupt the planet.
It's like trying to build a house by carrying individual cinder blocks in your backpack up the steepest mountain on the planet.
Which is exactly why we wouldn't carry anything up the mountain.
Okay. So what's the workaround?
Well, Earth has a massive gravity well. It takes an absurd amount of energy just to escape it.
Right. The rockets have to be huge just to get a tiny payload into orbit.
Exactly. So the primary economic advantage of a space settlement is that it sits completely outside that gravity well.
Ah, I see.
Once it's built, importing and exporting goods around the solar system is incredibly cheap. But to build it in the first place, we have to use ISRU.
ISRU, in-situ resource utilization.
You got it.
So it's like hiking into the woods with just an axe and building a log cabin using the trees around you.
That is a perfect analogy, yeah. We aren't bringing bricks from Earth. We mine asteroids or the moon.
We mine the moon.
Yeah. Lunar rock is actually full of oxygen that can be extracted for breathing. We can mine water, we can make rocket fuel, and we can even manufacture solar panels entirely from lunar dust.
Wait, really? Solar panels from moon dust?
Yeah, it has the right silicates.
Yeah.
And because the moon and asteroids have incredibly shallow gravity wells, they have a very low delta V.
Delta V? Could you explain that one for us?
Sure. Think of it as the energy budget required to change lanes on a cosmic highway.
Okay, I like that.
Pulling a rock off the moon requires just a tiny fraction of the energy it takes to pull that exact same rock off Earth.
Okay, so we're getting our rocks from the moon. But where are we actually parking this floating city? Because the original 1970s plans talked about Lagrange points, right? Like L4 and L5.
Right, they did. If you imagine gravity as a landscape, a Lagrange point is like balancing a marble perfectly on a saddle between two hills.
So it doesn't roll away.
Exactly. It's a spot in space where the gravitational pull of the Earth and the pull of the moon perfectly balance each other out, along with the orbital motion.
So if you park a city there, it just stays put.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah.
You won't drift away, which saves you a lot of fuel you'd otherwise need for station keeping.
But the more modern proposals in our material, they suggest a different location. They talk about a 2-to-1 resonance orbit.
Yeah, and that is honestly an economic stroke of genius.
How so?
A 2-to-1 resonance orbit means the settlement circles the Earth, but its path is timed so that it alternates getting really close to the moon and then really close to Earth.
Oh, I see. So it acts like a massive orbital ferry.
You've got it. It gives you cheap, close-range access to the raw building materials of the moon, and then loops right back to give you easy access to the major economic market of Earth.
That is so smart. But even with a great orbit and all these lunar materials, how are we moving millions of tons of lunar ore to the construction site without going bankrupt buying rocket fuel?
By abandoning traditional rockets entirely.
Really? No rockets.
None for moving the ore. The designs propose using mass drivers.
Mass drivers.
Yeah. Picture a magnetic catapult or like a maglev train track pointing up at the sky.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You use electricity to magnetically accelerate buckets of cheap lunar ore to escape velocity, literally hurling them into space where a catcher spacecraft collects them.
So you're just throwing rocks into space with magnets.
Basically, you're moving mountains of material using just solar electricity. No expensive chemical fuel required.
All right, so we've catapulted our lunar rocks. We have our orbital plot of land on that ferry route. But here is the massive elephant in the room, right?
Space is deadly.
Space is actively trying to kill us. If we are parked out at L4 or L5 or on a long resonance orbit, we are outside of the Earth's protective magnetic field about 2/3 of the time.
Yeah, we lose that magnetosphere protection.
That means anyone living there is completely exposed to solar wind and cosmic rays. How do we build a roof that stops that?
Radiation is arguably the biggest engineering hurdle in the whole project. To give you an idea of the math, about 7 centimeters of water will block half of the incoming cosmic radiation.
Okay, 7 centimeters doesn't sound too bad.
It doesn't, but that just blocks half. To get the dosage down to safe, Earth-like levels for permanent living, meaning raising kids, living your whole life there, you need mass. A lot of it.
How much mass?
Specifically, about 4 metric tons of rock for every single square meter of the settlement's outer hull.
Wait, really? 4 metric tons per square meter. So we are essentially wrapping our pristine high-tech space cities in millions of tons of crude lunar dirt.
We are. And I know it sounds incredibly primitive, just piling dirt on top of a spaceship.
Sounds like burying a submarine in a sandbox.
Exactly. But it's actually an elegant two birds, one stone engineering solution.
Okay, what's the second bird?
Well, out in space, invisible radiation isn't your only threat. You also have hypervelocity micrometeoroids and space dust.
Oh, right. Fast-moving pebbles.
Fast is an understatement. If you build a delicate glass bubble, a tiny pebble moving at 20,000 miles an hour will just shatter it.
That would be catastrophic.
Totally. But the NASA Ames Stanford Torus design, for example, uses a cosmic ray shield made of packed lunar sand that's almost 2 meters thick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that massive rock shield required to block the radiation perfectly doubles as impenetrable physical armor against space debris.
Okay, so we've built this massive impenetrable rock vault to keep the universe out. But if it's keeping the universe out, it's also keeping everything else in.
Right.
How do we avoid suffocating in our own breath? Or, you know, freezing to death in the cold of space.
Interestingly enough, freezing is not the problem at all.
It's not, but space is freezing.
Space is cold, yes, but because the habitat is surrounded by the vacuum of space, it effectively acts like a giant thermos bottle.
Oh, because vacuum is an insulator.
Exactly. Vacuum doesn't conduct heat away. It's a fantastic insulator. Meanwhile, you're catching an abundance of solar energy, about 1,400 watts of raw power per square meter in Earth orbit.
That's a lot of heat coming in.
Plus, you have millions of light bulbs, machines, and human bodies inside the habitat, and all of those are generating heat.
So we're not freezing, we're roasting inside a giant thermos.
Which means heat rejection is a massive problem.
Mm-hmm.
The designs require huge central radiators to constantly absorb that internal heat and radiate it out into the blackness of space as infrared light.
Just to keep the AC running, basically.
Just to keep the internal climate from cooking everyone, yeah.
And then there is the air. We need a normal mix of oxygen, which, like you said, we baked out of the lunar rocks.
Yep.
And nitrogen, which the sources say we might have to import from Earth or extract from comet ammonia.
Right. Nitrogen's a bit harder to find locally.
But once we have the air, keeping it clean seems like a nightmare. You can't just plant a forest of hydroponic tomatoes and assume they'll do all the work, right?
No, plants aren't enough. I mean, they process carbon dioxide, sure,
yeah.
But they don't remove industrial pollutants or off-gassing plastics or volatile oils from human skin.
So how do we clean the air in a sealed can?
For that, space settlements will likely borrow heavily from the technology used in nuclear submarines.
Oh, because submarines are basically underwater spaceships.
Exactly. They are currently humanity's best example of long-term closed environments. They rely on things called catalytic burners.
Catalytic burners? What do those do?
These machines literally heat the air and decompose complex organic pollutants down to basic, safe molecules.
That's pretty clever.
They also use cryogenic distillation, literally freezing the air, to pull out heavy impurities like mercury vapor and noble gases that you can't just burn away.
Okay, so we've scrubbed the air. But in a completely closed loop, the law of conservation of mass applies.
Matter can't just disappear.
Right. So what do we actually do with the toxic sludge we just pulled out of the air? Or the garbage? Or, frankly, the sewage?
You recycle it. All of it.
Now, if you're listening to this while drinking your morning coffee, you might want to put the mug down for a second.
Yeah, fair warning.
Because the proposed method here is wild. The sources say they take garbage, dead plant matter, sewage, and the leftover junk from the air scrubbers, and they burn it all in an electric arc.
Yeah, they basically zap it with artificial lightning.
It's crazy. Then they distill the result. The CO2 and water are immediately piped back into the agricultural greenhouses. And the leftover ash is dissolved to extract pure minerals for fertilizer.
It's extremely efficient.
So your morning coffee was literally yesterday's sewage zapped by lightning and fed to a soybean plant.
It's true. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it really demands a complete paradigm shift in how human beings view consumption.
How so?
Well, in a space settlement, absolute zero waste isn't just a trendy buzzword. It's a mathematical necessity for survival. There is no way to throw things.
You can't just take the trash out to the curb.
Exactly. Every single atom of carbon, every drop of moisture, every flake of rust is part of a precious, strictly accounted for chemical budget. You don't really own the atoms in your food.
You're just borrowing them.
You're just renting them before they go back into the electric arc.
That is deeply humbling. Okay, so we have air, our climate is controlled, our coffee is light and recycled, we are surviving.
Technically surviving, yes.
But human bodies evolved for Earth's gravity. If we are just floating in zero G for years, our bone density plummets, our immune systems get wrecked, our cardiovascular systems go completely haywire.
It's really bad for us long term.
So we have to simulate Earth's pull by spinning the habitat and using centrifugal force. But there are physical limits to this, right? We can't just spin a small tin can and call it a day.
No, we can't. And the limiting factor is actually the human inner ear.
The inner ear, really.
Yeah. Inside your ear, you have these fluid-filled canals that detect motion. If you build a habitat with a rotational radius of less than 100 meters, or if you spin it faster than 3 rotations per minute, the physics get very, very weird.
Weird how?
It's called the Coriolis effect. If you're in a fast-spinning small cylinder, the fluid in your ear ends up moving at a different relative speed than your head when you turn it.
Oh, that sounds nauseating.
It is. Your brain gets a massive sensory mismatch. It leads to dramatic, debilitating motion sickness.
The vomit limit.
Yes, the vomit limit. That's actually what it's known as.
I love that.
So centrifuge studies dictate the comfort zone here. To mimic a 1G Earth environment without making everyone terribly sick, the settlement needs to be huge.
How huge are we talking?
You need a rotational radius larger than 500 meters, and it needs to spin very slowly below 1 rotation per minute.
Okay.
At that scale, the centrifugal force perfectly mimics gravity, and you can turn your head or run around without ever feeling the spin.
But here is a detail from the blueprints that I absolutely loved. Because the gravity is created by spin, it's only strong at the outer edge of the cylinder, right?
Exactly, the floor of the habitat.
But as you move inward toward the very center axis of the rotation, the artificial gravity gets weaker and weaker until it just drops to zero.
It totally disappears at the dead center.
So if you enclose that center axis, you get a massive zero gravity playground right in the middle of your city.
Yeah, the recreation potential is amazing.
The designs talk about zero G swimming pools, hang gliding, and literal human-powered flight. You could strap on wings and fly like a bird down the center of your town.
It's an incredible visual. But, you know, that architectural design brings up a massive psychological challenge.
Oh, what kind of challenge?
Because no matter how big you build it or how incredibly fun that zero-G center is, the residents fundamentally know they live inside a machine.
Yeah, I guess. Wouldn't it feel like living inside a giant shopping mall?
Yeah, exactly.
Endless metal corridors, perfectly manicured parks, perfectly controlled thermostats. That kind of sterility has to take a psychological toll.
It absolutely would. And the source material emphasizes that interior design has to actively counteract that feeling.
How do they do that?
You can't just build a utilitarian grid like a city block. You have to design sight lines that are intentionally blocked so you can't see the entire scope of the settlement all at once.
To trick the brain.
Right. You need rolling landscapes, hills and valleys, so it doesn't feel like you are standing on a flat theater stage.
You have to trick the brain into feeling a sense of discovery, like there's something over the next hill.
Exactly. For psychological health, the human brain needs the illusion of serendipity. The planners insist on incorporating uncontrolled natural elements.
Like what? What isn't controlled?
Well, you program the climate systems to produce random artificial weather.
Oh, like a sudden rainstorm that wasn't on the weekly schedule?
Precisely. And you allow vegetation to grow wild and develop naturally in certain areas rather than pruning everything into perfect geometric boxes.
So it feels organic.
Right. People need to feel that nature still exists, that the environment isn't completely subservient to some guy at a control panel.
Okay, so we understand the physics, the psychology, the life support, the gravity, but what do these megastructures actually look like? Because the concepts and the sources, they outline a whole progression of human ambition.
They do. And they generally start with what's called Island One, which is also known as the Bernal Sphere.
A sphere, okay.
Yeah, this is a spherical habitat designed to hold about 10,000 to 20,000 people. It's the starter model.
Right.
Then you scale up to the famous O'Neill Cylinder, or Island Three. These are massive. It's a pair of cylinders, each roughly 2 to 2.5 miles in radius and 20 miles long.
20 miles long. But the one that seemed the most realistic to me was the dumbbell concept.
Oh, the modular one.
Yeah, it's modular. You don't need a multi-trillion dollar startup investment to build a 20-mile cylinder all at once.
It's just much easier to fund.
Exactly. You start small with two smaller habitats connected by a cable spinning around each other for gravity. And then as the population grows, you just add to it.
It's very practical.
The dumbbell becomes a bow tie, then a ring, then a whole interconnected web. It mimics how Earth cities actually grow, expanding incrementally, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood.
And if you extrapolate that incremental growth and you introduce theoretical materials like carbon nanotubes to handle the immense tensile stress, you get the McKendree cylinder.
Now, that one is terrifyingly huge.
We are talking about a paired cylinder structure with a radius of nearly 300 miles and a length of almost 3,000 miles.
That is a continuous enclosed continent floating in space. A structure that big would have its own internal time zones.
Oh, absolutely.
It would develop completely distinct regional cultures at different ends of the cylinder. People on one side might never visit the other.
It fundamentally redefines what a human habitat can even be.
It does, but I have to bring up my absolute favorite. The one that completely floored me when I read it was Dandridge M. Cole's concept from 1964.
Bubble world.
The bubble world. Because the sheer audacity of the engineering here is just staggering.
It's basically mad science in the best way.
It really is. Okay, so you find a massive, solid, metallic asteroid. You drill a single tunnel right down its longest axis, and you pack that tunnel full of water or ice. Then you weld the ends completely shut. Next, you build a giant solar reflector mirror nearby to focus the intense heat of the sun directly onto the asteroid.
Just baking it.
Yeah, you slowly heat the entire rock until the iron literally softens.
And as that iron softens, the water that you trapped inside the core begins to boil.
Right. The water flashes into steam, the pressure builds, and because the metal is soft now, the steam inflates the solid iron asteroid like a glass ornament.
It's incredible to picture.
You blow it up like a balloon, you let it cool into a hollow shell, spin it for gravity, and then fill the inside with dirt and air. You've essentially forged a bespoke planetary habitat out of raw cosmic iron using nothing but sunlight and steam.
It perfectly captures the incredible progression of human ingenuity we're seeing in these sources.
It really does.
I mean, we start with the utilitarian dumbbell just to barely survive the vacuum, and we scale up to literally hollowing out and inflating asteroids like balloons.
It is an incredible journey. I mean, we started this deep dive looking at the sci-fi dreams of an 1869 serial story, and we followed it all the way to 1970s Princeton mathematics.
A lot of ground covered.
We learned how to pull rocks off the moon using magnetic catapults, how to use that dirt as bulletproof armor against the Unibus, and how to recycle our own waste with artificial lightning just to survive inside a giant spinning thermos bottle.
It sounds absurd when you list it all out like that, but the math holds up.
It does. Just imagine waking up in an O'Neill cylinder. You make your lightning recycled coffee, you look out your window, and instead of a blue sky, you see another town complete with forests, lakes, and clouds hanging completely upside down, 3 miles directly above your head.
It completely reshapes our understanding of reality. And if we pull back and look at the absolute largest implication of everything we've discussed today, it leads to a really profound final thought.
Oh, what's that?
Well, the source material briefly mentions that these space settlements could theoretically serve as passenger compartments for generation ships.
Generation ships, like traveling to other stars.
Exactly. Think about the gravity of that idea. If humanity successfully builds a fully self-sustaining, closed-loop McKendree or O'Neill cylinder.
A city that recycles its own atoms.
Right. A city that generates its own weather and doesn't rely on Earth for a single drop of water or breath of air. What is stopping that city from simply attaching a propulsion drive to the back, leaving the solar system, and becoming an interstellar arc?
Wow. It wouldn't just be an orbital station anymore.
No.
It would be the exact moment a human city becomes a completely independent traveling starship.
The ultimate freedom from the gravity well.
That is just, man. We started out by imagining how impossibly hard it would be to pour concrete while falling down a bottomless elevator shaft in a vacuum.
Yeah.
But it turns out, if you can figure out how to build a house while falling, you don't ever have to hit the ground. You can just keep flying.
Keep on flying.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep looking up.